Hi Patreon subscribers. Welcome and thanks for your support. Many of you voted to have me address sympathy and empathy from an evolutionary perspective. I think it's an excellent choice. The topic is one of my favorites, and it couldn't possibly be more important at this moment in history. I'm not going to attempt to define these terms etymologically, to say how they came into usage and what they have meant in the past. My purpose here is to define them for maximum value. For that to be achieved, the two have to be defined precisely such that they interact in a way to cover the territory to maximum effect. Let's talk a bit about adaptive evolution. We all tend to think of evolution as about the past, and indeed, there's good reason for that. But adaptive evolution occurs because it prepares creatures to deal with future environments. The past cannot be changed. The future is where one's profits can be enhanced and one's costs can be reduced. And so that's what evolution is about. When we think about sympathy and empathy, it would be good for us to think about them in that context. Let's start with empathy. Human beings are very special creatures. Far beyond any other creature that has existed, we are programmed by experiences that we have after we are born. One result of that is that one human being and another may differ to a great degree, and this means that the range of behavior may be quite wide. At the same time, we are very highly social creatures, which means that our success as human beings is largely dictated by how well we interface with others of our kind. So, in order to do that well, it is very valuable to be able to predict what other people are going to think, what they will feel, and ultimately what they are going to do in response to changes in their circumstances. Empathy is the very special evolved tool that we use to figure out what other people are going to do in response to changes in their circumstance. So, if I'm to talk about empathizing with you, in order to empathize with you, I run the data of your circumstance through my mind to see how I would feel if I was in your shoes. If our minds are similar because we've had similar developmental histories, then I may be very effective at this. If our minds are very different because we've had very different developmental trajectories, then I may have nothing more than a crude sketch. It's still probably better than nothing, but it's not going to be nearly as good as if you and I have shared a great deal of history. The value of my empathy with you, however, does not depend on whether or not we're on the same team. It is important to understand one's enemies if one is to defeat them, just as it is important to understand one's allies if one is to aid them. Empathy does not pay any heed to whether or not the person that you are empathizing with is your enemy or your ally. Now, I've spoken so far as if empathy is a general capacity, that two people have something like a coefficient that dictates how well they can empathize with each other, and in general, that's probably true. There are certainly going to be places, though, where two people can empathize to a great degree, but then fail in some particular zone. For example, I grew up in Los Angeles in the 1970s and 80s. If I meet somebody else who grew up under similar circumstances in the same place, I may have a lot of insight into how they're going to see the world. But if that person is female, there may be some set of circumstances or events that I understand less well because they don't mirror my own experience. The same can be said for generational differences. If I meet another biologist, I may understand a lot about how they see the world, but if that biologist is a baby boomer, then they grew up in boom times and I did not, and that may affect the way we understand each other. It is also possible to bootstrap empathy where one does not share developmental circumstances with somebody else. Extensive contact between two people who are dissimilar can result in coming to understand how the other person sees the world. This may also be why human beings are obsessed with narratives. We love movies and novels in large measure because they run us through circumstances that we will never face so that we can understand how characters in those circumstances see the world, and if we ever run up against somebody who has had a similar experience, we may know a great deal more about it than we would otherwise. Scientific study can also reveal such things. Behavioral scientists in the last several decades have come to understand that, contrary to most of our expectation, human beings often value a particular opportunity not in absolute terms, how good is the opportunity, but in relative terms, how good is that opportunity relative to what other people have. knowing that allows us to correct for one of our expectations. All right, now let's talk about sympathy. Sympathy, I will argue, is empathy plus alignment. Now, this fits the etymology. Sympathy, same pathos. And what this means is that if I empathize with somebody so that I know the way in which they're likely to view a particular circumstance, and I also am in alignment with them, that is to say, they are on my team, then my emotional experience at their plight is liable to be parallel to their emotional experience. So, it makes intuitive sense. If I'm watching a film of an enemy of mine, and they are struggling to answer questions from a hostile member of the press, well, then I can appreciate that they are feeling terror and maybe embarrassment. But my emotional experience of watching them suffer through these things may be one of relief or even pleasure. You know, the German term Schadenfreude comes to mind, meaning pleasure that one takes at somebody else's misfortune. Now, if I'm watching a friend of mine face the same circumstance, well, then I am liable to feel their terror and embarrassment right along with them. That would be sympathy. Now, some final thoughts. Many things involve important kinds of empathy and sympathy that we don't typically associate with those terms. When musicians get together to play music, they have to understand what each other are going to do in order to interface in an effective way. If they're playing in front of an audience, they also have to figure out how the audience is going to hear what's being played in order to be maximally effective. The same can be said for a humorist or an animator. And lastly, educators face the situation. It is not enough to simply deliver correct content and imagine that the audience is going to understand it. One has to know how the audience is going to hear what is being said so that they can come to a new understanding of something they didn't see before. I hope this has been useful. I look forward to seeing your comments, and I also look forward to the next video. All right, Brett and Heather here, perched on a hillside near Mount Shasta to talk in light of your recent publication in Quillette, Heather, and some of the feedback that you've gotten. We're going to talk a little bit about sex, and in particular, we're going to talk about some of the evolutionary lens through which one might view sex. Start with the basic. Is it better to be a man or a woman?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Better to be...
It is neither better to be male nor female in any population that is experiencing sex ratios, the likes of which every population that we know of, with exceedingly rare exceptions, have experienced throughout history.
Yes, but you evaded the question I asked you, man or woman?
I've always enjoyed being female.
You've always enjoyed being female.
I've always enjoyed you being male.
I see,
yep.
Yes. Well,
being straight and all. And it is a mathematical inevitability that either sex, which is limiting, which there are not enough, will be produced in greater numbers the next generation because they will be the more valuable one.
Yes, and that sounds very technical. But in the case of men and women, is it not clear that it is better to be a man because if you play your cards right, you get to go to bed with women?
Ah, see, now that said like a straight man. My feeling is, as you might imagine, the corollary, which is that not really even having to play your cards right, you get to engage with men sexually, but if you play your cards right, you get to go to bed, as you say, with excellent men.
Yes, I see. That's all very confusing. I can't imagine why anyone would want to do it. And I must say, should reincarnation be a real thing, mm-hmm. which I assume it isn't, since there's zero evidence for it, but if it's a real thing, I hope, assuming that reincarnation does not involve us interacting in the future, I hope you do come back as a man so that you can test your hypothesis.
I don't even know what to do with this.
All right. Well, so,
somehow,
yeah.
there's tracks right over there.
Yes.
Somehow we've gone off the rails even being near them.
We did not start out on the rails. Yeah. I will grant you that. All right. So let's
Let's go back to the question that you seemed insistent on attempting to answer here, which is it better to be male or female? Is it not obvious that it is better to be male because in most species, males can produce huge numbers of offspring, and females, because they invest more in each offspring, produce smaller numbers? So evolution being what it is, and it having something to do with producing large numbers of offspring, isn't it evolutionarily better to be male?
No, because every man imagines that he's that guy, that he's going to be the Genghis Khan of his generation and produce more kids than anyone else ever has. And of course, no modern man is thinking in terms of production of kids, but the proxy is, I'm going to have a lot of sex. I'm going to have a lot of sex with a lot of women, maybe settling down, but also keeping my eye out for all the other sexual opportunities that are out there. Most men aren't that guy. And so in a population in which there is a Genghis Khan, there are many, many men. There are many. God, I hope not.
I'm getting a late start at it, that's okay. For sure. We can agree that as Genghis Khans go, I'm not an early bloomer.
Well, can we agree that you're going to keep your eyes on the prize that is our children that are already extant in the universe?
Yeah. No, they're my first priority for sure.
Okay. In a population where Genghis Khan exists, there are going to be a ton of men who are involuntarily celibate, whereas in any population across human history, and indeed across the broad swath of other organisms, all females end up reproducing. And so the variability in what is called reproductive success for females is far lower than the variability in reproductive success for males. And in fact, we see that greater male variability hypothesis borne out in a number of other areas in terms of things like mathematical ability as well. But in terms of reproductive success, the male who has reproduced the most has had far more kids than any woman could. And certainly there are some women who have had no children and some men who have had no children, so it would appear that the lower limit is just the same, and while the number is the same, zero, the number of men throughout history who have left no offspring is an order of magnitude higher than the percentage of women in any given population who leave no offspring.
So if we imagine that the average man sits at some position in terms of number of offspring that he leaves at any given moment in history, for everyone who beats the odds, there's one who underperforms. Is that fair to say?
Exactly.
And so the same thing is true for females. Because it takes a male and a female to produce offspring in creatures like us, there is an equal average in the population for the number of offspring produced, but the variance is much greater for males.
Quite so. So in any population where polygyny, often more generically and slightly less precisely called polygamy, in any population where polygamy is a norm, there will be more women than men reproducing in the population. But that does not change the fact that every single one of us, barring gross cases of incest, have an exactly equal number of male and female ancestors.
Okay, so in a case, let's say it's human beings, and there's been a war that has eliminated a large number of men from a population, is it now better to be male or female?
Better in terms of that moment in time?
If you were a parent producing offspring, would it be better to produce male offspring or female offspring at that instant?
Well, actually, the answer is the same. In the moment, you are going to produce more kids if you're male, because your males are limiting. Therefore, you are a rare commodity. And into the next generation, especially if you can produce kids quickly, that is likely to be the case until it corrects. And so boys are, for the moment, going to be more valuable and therefore produced in greater numbers.
So?
And the inverse would also be true. In the case where, for instance, there has been a lot of sex-selective abortion, as is true in some cultures, women are limiting, and therefore women become more valuable and have greater choice among partners when they come of age.
Which I must say raises a deep question that I've never heard well answered, and I'm afraid the answer is actually quite frightening. But in a culture where women are less common because of selective abortion, you should imagine that women would be in high demand, and therefore they should be prized as offspring, and yet that is not typically what we understand from such cultures. So that's a mystery that we have to address separately.
Cultural norms don't change as quickly as we think they should be able to.
I actually don't think that cuts it.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think it's fully explanatory, but it's true. I think that is an observation without being particularly explanatory.
I think there is something about the fact that the cultural norm, which obviously could turn on a dime, does not shift in the direction of female offspring, that suggests that actually an overproduction of male offspring has a value that we have yet to describe.
Well, we've been talking about adaptive value at the individual level. And a population will be better suited to something like warfare if it has an overproduction of men.
Yeah, but our field has yet to acknowledge that that level of selection exists. And so in some sense, I think we are upended here by the fact that we don't have the right tools yet. But so let's just finish out the general biological case. It is not better to be male or female because although the variance is higher for males and therefore a super successful male is better than a super successful female from the perspective of how many offspring he produces, the chances of underperforming counteract the value of overperforming so that males and females end up dead even.
And in a stable population, which of course humans on Earth aren't, we are a growing population, but in a stable population, on average, every man and every woman produces two offspring that survive to reproduce with the next generation, two and only two, no matter how many they produce, no matter if they're frogs that produce 10,000 per mating event or people who produce one. In a stable population that is not growing, it is again mathematically true that only two of those children that were produced via sexual means, as opposed to via some kind of asexual reproduction like cloning or parthenogenesis, will survive to reproduce themselves.
Yep. I always try to be careful about this, because when you say every, you're talking about on average. And of course, there's nothing that says you can't have some couples that wildly overproduce the two offspring that would replace them in the population, and other couples underperform it just the same way individuals can overperform or underperform. But on average, in a stable population, every pair produces two offspring that survive to reproduce. And that's just simply a mathematical fact. But the logic to walk away from this with is, from the point of view of producing offspring, males and females in a population in which males and females are equally common are equally valuable. There are reasons that an individual might want to produce males or females if that individual knows something about what sorts of offspring it's going to produce. But absent that information, males and females are equally valuable. In a population in which either males or females have become rare, producing the rare sex has disproportionate value. And so there are moments in time at which the logic does not hold for a given population, and being one or the other is better. But there is not a bias in terms of which sex ought to be better. In other words, it's whatever sex happens to be in short supply. That may be males, because males are risk takers. It may be more frequent that males are in low supply, and therefore producing males will have an extra benefit for the parents who do it. But in general, it's a matter of which sex has become rare.
Right. Historically, the risks to males have been things like hunting and warfare. And the risks to females have been, in humans, childbirth.
Hunting, warfare, and anything that follows, hold my beer.
Indeed.
Or watch this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a biggie for men.
Sometimes for boys, look ma, no hands.
Look ma, no hands,
mm-hmm.
Or hold my root beer also.
Yes,
that one
true.
Sometimes. Yeah. All right. Well, I think this is a good introductory lesson in terms of how to think about sex from an evolutionary perspective.
Hey, folks. If you like this video, click like, subscribe to the channel, and if you feel like supporting the creation of more content like this, head on over to my Patreon page and sign up at whatever level feels comfortable.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.